May I have your attention? People always start out wondering, who's that crazy guy at the microphone? I'm John Dealey. I'm a professor emeritus of chemical engineering and a member of the campus community committee. I was for quite some years chair of the retiree affairs committee of the McGill Association of University Teachers, a job which has just been taken over by Professor Gowri Sankaran, known to many people at McGill. So, on behalf of the Campus Community Committee, Human Resources, and the retiree section of MUT, I'm pleased to welcome you to this event for McGill retirees, alumni, faculty, staff, and friends. Now, I want to explain how it's going to work. First speaker is going to be Joe Schwartz, and then we'll have Jill Barker. It'll be continuous, except when Jill starts, she will lead you in a break that will allow you to stretch your muscles so that you won't grow, you won't be damaged by rigor in sitting too long. And we'll defer questions until everyone has, both the presentations have finished. So our first speaker is Joe Schwartz. He's director of McGill's Office for Science and Society. He's well known for his informative and entertaining public lectures on topics ranging from the chemistry of love to the science of aging. Dr. Schwartz has received numerous awards for teaching chemistry and for interpreting science in an understandable way for the public. He holds honorary doctorates from two Canadian universities. He hosts the Dr. Joe Show on Montreal's CJAD, has appeared hundreds of times on television, and Dr. Schwartz writes a regular newspaper column and has authored a number of books. He's also a not-so-amateur conjurer and often spices up his presentations with magic tricks. And now, here's Joe.
Well, thanks very much. That was not Robert Browning. Robert Browning, of course, was a famous British poet. And I suspect that many of you will recall some of his classic lines, especially this one, "Grow old along with me, the best is yet to be," said Robert Browning. Must have been clowning. Let's face it, growing old is not that great. The aging process, well, you know, I think we'd rather do without it. There's a lot of stuff out there that we don't really look forward to, do we? We hear about the golden years, but the fact is that there's stuff in those golden years that really isn't worth looking forward to. As, you know, when our plumbing starts to go astray in all kinds of ways, some more problematic than others. And then, of course, we try to see what we can do to remedy the problem. And luckily, science does afford us some remedies for some of these. But people approach old age in different ways. But wouldn't it be great if we could overcome the hurdles of aging, stretch out our years, grow old, and be able to do the same kind of things that we did when we were young? Well, some people can. They age remarkably well. They have the right genes. That's important, of course. You've got to select your parents properly. But unfortunately, for most of us, that's not the way things go. The body begins to break down. And, of course, there's consequences, and we worry about it. But somehow, you know, we expect our body to decline. That's the normal process. Where we really get upset is when the memory starts to fade. Because the first time that you don't remember where you put your keys, you say, gee, you know, is that the first sign of Alzheimer's disease? Memory is an absolutely fascinating business. And when you just can't remember something, think, gee, you know, what comes next? This really hits home in terms of aging. There's fascinating science behind memory. You know, sometimes you will just smell something, apple pie, and immediately you're transported back to your grandmother's kitchen. There's this amazing link, right, between the sense of smell and memory. Now this, of course, can be used. Studies have shown that when you learn something in the presence of a smell, you can remember it better in the presence of the same smell. So for example, if you study for an exam and you have the smell of chocolate in the room, and then you write the exam and you open up a bar of chocolate, you will remember better. Studies have shown that. The question is it is allowed? On final exams, no, there's no food that can be brought in. It's not because we worry about this, we worry about it being disguised as some receiver or something. But this is an amazing thing, the way that memory comes back. To me, any time I see someone chewing bubble gum, you know the mental image that comes to me? Without fail, it's coming right now, is that. Now, what on earth connection could this possibly be? Well, let me tell you. Back when I was in grade 6, in old Logan School here. Anybody went to Logan School in Montreal? Miss Wolofsky was my teacher in grade 6. And she hated kids who chewed gum. And if you chewed gum, you of course had to take it out, throw it out, and you had to stand up on a chair and recite a poem. The gum-chewing student and the cut-chewing cow are different somehow. I know, it's the intelligent look on the face of the cow. I can't look at someone chewing gum without this little poem coming into my mind. Interestingly enough, these days we are told that we can chew gum to improve our memory. If you take a look at the claims on this brain gum, brings mental alertness, because it contains a compound called phosphatidylserine, which actually is present in the brain, and it is in the cell membrane, and it does control transmission of information. So there is a potential link here, and they actually have a study which showed that people look at list of names, then they chew the gum, they look at another list, and they're asked to tick off which name they saw before, and they can remember it better if they're chewing gum. Interesting. Except that they never had a control. They didn't do the test of what happens if you chew gum without that ingredient. Well, that test now has been done. And it turns out that it's the chewing of the gum that matters. Never mind whether it has any active ingredient or not. We don't know why, but when you read something, trying to learn something, and you're chewing gum, you will remember it better. So there's interesting stuff that comes out of this science. So let's take a look at that interesting stuff, the machinations that go in our brain and what memory really is all about. Let's start with something very, very basic, the fly. You don't get much more basic than that. The reason we start with this is because that is really how I got interested in this whole area of memory. One day I was having breakfast, having my steel-cut oats, with the spoonful of flaxseed on top, and of course the blueberries. And a fly lands in front of my plate. So I did what most people would do. I shooed the fly away. And he left. But then he came back. And I shooed him away again. Came back, I shooed him away again. And this game of man and fly went on through several repetitions. And then eventually, he no longer came back to me, but he came back to the table and landed in front of my kids and my wife. He had obviously learned that I was a dangerous man. So I started to think, is that really possible? Could that fly have really learned? Is there such a thing as fly memory? These days, of course, when you have a mystery like that, you let your fingers do the dancing on the keyboard and you Google. And it turns out that at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on Long Island, they've actually done studies like this. They've taken flies and attempted to train them. They would put them in a glass box and expose them to the scent of licorice root, followed by an electric shock. Obviously not enough to kill them, but enough to make sure that they sense something. And then, to investigate whether or not there was an association between the shock and the licorice root, they took the flies, put them into another glass box, which had two outlets. One into another box that had the scent of licorice, the other one had no scent. They wanted to see which way the flies would go. And indeed, it turned out that statistically significant more flies flew in the direction away from the licorice, meaning that they had learned. Of course, it was only a slight excess. They hadn't all learned. So the ones that did learn, of course, flew the direction opposite. The ones who didn't learn, of course, just went about randomly. They had names for the two kinds of flies. There were the smart flies and the dumb flies. And the question came up, of course, what's the difference? They did an autopsy of the flies' brains. And there are people who do this. You can do an autopsy of the fly's brain. Might be surprising, but I mean, if we can make Twinkies, we can do autopsies of flies' brains. And what they discovered, that there was a difference. There was a protein that was present in higher concentrations in the brains of the fly that had learned to avoid the licorice. And this was a specific protein that had a function. Its function was to make connections to other brain cells. And it is these interconnections between brain cells where memory is located. Our nervous system is a vast array of neurons or nerve cells. The more connections are forged between them, the better the information transmission. I can give you an analogy to this. I think it's a very appropriate analogy. Let's go back a few years when we used to have a telephone exchange. You could actually talk to a human being. You would pick up the telephone, you would tell them what number you wanted, they would take a cable and plug it into the right hole, and you'd speak. Of course, there were limits to the number of such connections that could be made. Today, look where we have come with our cell phones. You can take your cell phone, you can be at the bottom of the ocean, and to speak to someone in the Himalayas. We have more possible connections. Right? You can speak to anyone, anytime, anywhere in the world. Well, this is a very, very apt analogy. Because what happens in our brain as we grow is that these connections get made. And when you learn, when you study, more connections get made. That's of what memory is composed. The brain is a remarkably complex organ. It is more complicated than any computer that has ever been built. We don't understand everything about it, but surprisingly, we do understand a fair bit. Let's see what we do understand. Well, we saw flies. They're pretty primitive, but we saw that they can learn. Let's go up. Let's go to rodents. If you take rodents and you put them in a cage where they have access to running on a treadmill or to solving mazes, which of course is an occupational requirement for laboratory rats, they have to know how to learn to solve mazes. And you compare their intellectual aptitude to rats that have not been exposed to any of this, who grow up in boring cages. And it turns out that the rats that are intellectually exercised have more newly formed brain cells. So the same way that you can exercise your body, you can exercise your brain. Let's move up the scale. London taxi drivers. Somewhere in between rodents and humans. Why were they studied? Because London is an extremely complicated city. It has no two streets that are parallel to each other. It takes 2 years for a London taxi driver to learn how to navigate the streets. It's pretty complicated. You have to learn how to pick up the tourists at Heathrow Airport, how to take them to their downtown hotel, in the most roundabout way without them realizing that it is the most roundabout way. What researchers decided to do was to examine the brains of these taxi drivers as they were going through this 2-year program of learning how to navigate the city streets. And what they discovered was that the area of the brain where memory is located physically grew in size. Their brain hippocampus was being trained So when you have an intellectual challenge, the brain rises to the task. It makes more of these neuronal connections, which means that it processes data much, much better. So that's, of course, a plug for education. We should be teaching our kids all kinds of interesting things from early on in life. Have them play with chemistry sets. Or at least we used to be able to do that when chemistry sets had chemicals in them. These days, of course, that's a rarity. Because when you do this, you actually form more networks in the brain, more of these connections. Your brain becomes more adept. Well, education can even stave off Alzheimer's disease. Studies have shown that people who have higher degrees are less likely to succumb to this disease. Now, you have to be very careful about interpreting this. That's an association. That does not prove cause and effect. It may well be that people who are highly educated exercise more, they eat better, they get better medical care. Those are the kind of things why they may be less prone to diseases such as Alzheimer's. But certainly it is interesting to explore this possibility, and it is being explored. In a fascinating study that is centered at the University of Kentucky, researchers are looking at cloistered nuns, a rather rare species these days, but very interesting in terms of study because they have a very controlled life. They have very similar diets. They have very, very similar lifestyles. They don't interact much with the outside world. These nuns have willed their body to science. They have said that once they pass on, their brains can be autopsied and researchers can do whatever they want with them to see what can be learned. Well, early on in life, when they joined the order, these nuns were asked to write essays on what they thought their life as a nun would be like. And now, about 30 years later, experts looked at those essays and they evaluated them in terms of intellectual content, writing style, ideas, etc. And it turned out that the nuns with the lowest density of ideas per paragraph were the most likely to develop Alzheimer's disease. Predictable from that early on in life. Now, again, I don't want to overplay this card because there are many other factors, of course, that come into play with Alzheimer's disease. For example, a history of mini strokes is a much, much bigger risk factor than any type of education or intellectual ability. But certainly this merits being explored further. There are numerous anti-aging regimens out there that are being promoted, because the average age of the population, of course, is increasing. It's a big market. And people tend to have money as they get older. And there are all kinds of people who are willing to take their money from them with all kinds of interesting schemes. Let's take a look at some of these. Let's go back to the biblical era for a moment and King David. When King David was getting old and sick, he went to his physicians and asked them, "What should I do?" And they gave him sound medical advice. They said, "Go and lie with young women." This is a therapy that works. But very few doctors are willing to write prescriptions for it these days. The ancient Romans had a very similar idea. They thought that if they took young ladies, Roman virgins, and put them in a room overnight, without much ventilation, that their exhaled breath would have a rejuvenating effect. So the older Roman gentleman in the morning would come, open up a little window to this room, and inhale the exhaled breath of these virgins. And they felt better. They felt rejuvenated. I suspect they would have felt even better had they been allowed to go into the room and... So all these kind of things have been tried over the years. In the Middle Ages, the alchemists were looking for all kinds of ways to rejuvenate themselves. And they looked, believe it or not, in a most amazing place. They looked in urine. Why? Because urine was a golden color. And gold seemed to be immortal. Gold doesn't tarnish, gold doesn't rust. Unlike iron, right? They thought that it had some property that made it immortal. If they could isolate that property from gold and infuse it into themselves, they'd also achieve longevity, perhaps even immortality. The theory was that humans were born with a set amount of gold in their body. And slowly, as they aged, they peed their life away. So they searched in urine for the secret to life. And in 1669, a German alchemist by the name of Hennig Brand took a large vat of urine and wanted to boil it down to dryness to see what was in there. And he boiled and he boiled and he boiled. And the sun went down. And a remarkable thing happened. That bowl of urine began to glow in the dark. He thought for sure he had discovered the secret to life. He hadn't, but he did discover phosphorus. Because when you take organic matter and you boil it down and there's some phosphorus, phosphates in there, the phosphates get reduced to phosphorus, which glows in the dark. It changed human history because now you could make matches. Now you could light fires at will. Now you had a better way of killing your enemies. All because of the quest for longevity. But the first real serious research into methods to slow down the aging process occurred in the 1800s. Charles Brown Séquard was a French physiologist. He did research with rodents and later with dogs and discovered that when these animals were emasculated, that is when they were castrated, they got sick and they didn't live as long. And he figured that the testes were producing some substance that was important in preventing aging. He figured that the best way to try this would be to use a human extract of the appropriate matter. But there were surprisingly few donors for that experiment. So he did it with dogs and with chimpanzees. And he found that when he took an extract of the testes of these animals and injected it into castrated rodents and rats, they lived longer. As luck would have it, and indeed it seems it was lucky, when he was 72 years old, he married an 18-year-old young lady. And he worried that maybe in a couple of years he might not be able to perform his conjugal duties. So he put his research to task, and he injected himself with extracts of monkey glands. And he said that he felt rejuvenated. Who knows what happened? History records that his young wife did leave him 3 years later. Not everyone thought that this was the right thing to do. In fact, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who was a physician, of course the creator of Sherlock Holmes, thought that this was stretching where science should go. And indeed, he wrote a story, The Adventure of the Creeping Man, one of the best Sherlock Holmes stories. And it's the story of an aging physiology professor who marries a young lady and is worried that he might not be able to perform. And Sherlock Holmes is called into the case when the old professor is found swinging in the backyard from tree to tree because he had injected himself with monkey gland extract and ended up making a monkey of himself. Well, in the United States, John Romulus Brinkley heard about the exploits of Séquard in France, and he one-upped him. He thought, gee, you know, well, if these extract injections work, what about transplanting the whole gland? Well, he knew, of course, that there would be no human donors for this. But Brinkley had grown up on a farm, and he had seen the horny antics of goats. He knew that they were into frequent ferocious activity with great satisfaction. So he wondered whether or not a goat gland to man testicle transplant would be appropriate. So he went and he bought himself a mail order medical degree, which you could do in the 1800s. And he set up shop to become a surgeon. And he transplanted goat glands into men who complained of impotence, who complained of improper performance. During his life, he performed over 1,700 such operations with nary a complication, no medical training. How come no complication? Because although he did take the gold testicle and put it into the scrotum of man, he never connected it to anything. Now, that doesn't mean that it was inactive. I mean, certainly there was a placebo effect, which, of course, in that area of life is more important than in any other area. But it is also possible that small amounts of testosterone from that goat gland may have leached out, and he may, in fact, have performed history's first ever hormone treatment. He made a lot of money. He became famous for his transplants. And one of the best stories is that of a farmer who came to see him complaining of, you know, the usual problems that his wife had said, that he was becoming a flat tire. And he wanted the usual transplant, which was performed. A year later, Brinkley got a letter of thank you from the gentleman, saying that not only had he been able to perform like a young man, but he had even fathered a child. And the real punchline that I like is that he decided to call the child Billy. So that really was the ancestor of our hormone treatment. As you know, today testosterone in a purified form is used to try to prevent aging. That is used mostly in men. In women, of course, to try to counteract aging, it is estrogen therapy that is used. And it is not used quite as much today as it used to be because there is a link to breast cancer. But that link really is seen only when estrogen is used for a number of years after menopause. For short term, estrogen can be very safely used. So, of course, today this is done in a very, very scientific way with properly metered doses. But one of the most exciting areas of hormone treatment that has emerged is the use of what we call human growth hormone. Human growth hormone is a protein that is secreted by the pituitary gland as we grow, and it triggers all of the growth processes. As we reach maturity, the pituitary gland winds down its production of this hormone. So the question comes up, what if you introduce this hormone into an aging body? Might it slow down aging? An interesting idea. In 1990, a paper appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is not the National Enquirer. And the paper was headed by Daniel Rudman, a highly respected physician. And they took a bunch of men, just over a dozen, and injected them with human growth hormone, which at that time had to be extracted from the pituitary of cadavers. That was a very expensive process. It cost $1,700 for each man for 6 months of treatment. But the results were very interesting. Their skin thickness increased. The muscle mass increased relative to fat. These are all good things. These are all linked to anti-aging. The only problem was that the study had to be stopped after about 6 months because problems cropped up. Some of the men developed carpal tunnel syndrome. There were other complications. And in fact, Rudman had to write a letter to the editor saying that the study was stopped in order to try to stop the snowball that has started to roll because, of course, the press got wind of this anti-aging regimen. And pretty soon, we had clinics opening up, injecting people with human growth hormone for outrageous prices. And, of course, not talking at all about the risks that Rudman had actually seen. The FDA got into this and made human growth hormone injection illegal. But the quacks are always one step ahead of the game. And now they are marketing what they call secretagogues, which are the components of human growth hormone. This is a protein. Proteins, of course, are made up of amino acids. And their claim is that in this product, they have the mix of amino acids that the body needs to make this specific protein, so that if you take this regimen, you will manufacture more of this protein. This is total nonsense. This is like taking a bunch of windows and doors and bricks and piling them on an empty lot and hoping that they will assemble themselves into a building. The problem of lack of growth hormone production has nothing to do with lack of raw material. We eat protein all the time. We have a full complement of amino acids. It's just that the body no longer produces the enzymes that are needed to make the growth hormone. But millions and millions and millions of dollars have been made out of this scientific folly. Diet is not folly. Here we have pretty solid evidence that we can slow down the aging process with appropriate diet. It is always a problem to focus on one specific food because it gives undue value to that. There are good diets and bad diets. But good diets are made up of good foods. For example, blueberries. Now, I don't want to portray to you that this is some kind of magical ingredient. Research at Tufts University has focused on the high antioxidant content of blueberries. And these days, even those people who have absolutely no idea what antioxidants are have heard this name often enough to know that they want more of these in their body than less, which is, by and large, correct. The blue pigment that colors the blueberries has this antioxidant potential, which means that it can neutralize free radicals. Now, we're not talking about political dissidents. We're talking about a rogue species of molecule with an unshared electron that is looking to pick up another electron, and in order to do that, it can destroy other molecules. That's how we age. That's how disease develops, when DNA gets disrupted. Well, free radicals are the problem. If you neutralize them, you're doing something good, and the antioxidants can do that. We have some pretty interesting evidence about these particular ones, the anthocyanins in blueberries, in rodents. Now, we have to be careful here because the human is not a giant rat. Obviously, there are exceptions to that. But the rodents will eat as many blueberries as you give them. So they will, you keep giving them, they will gorge the blueberries. Now, here's the interesting study. If you examine the aging process in rats, what you notice is that there's a decreased response to these chemicals called neurotransmitters, which transmit information between nerve cells. But when you give them blueberries, you can restore that response. Rodents love to walk on narrow ledges. They love to walk on ropes. As they get older, they lose the ability to do that. They start to fall off. So if you go down to your basement and you look at your rats, and you see them scampering adroitly across the clothesline, you know you have a nice young population. But if they're falling off the rope, you better get out the blueberries because you got some seniors there. And you want to restore them. You want to make sure that they climb back on that rope. Now, what does it mean for us? Well, life really is like walking a tightrope, isn't it? We know that eventually we're going to fall off, but we want to stay on there as long as possible. Blueberries just might help that. Now, it is true that the amount of blueberries the rats have to eat to rejuvenate themselves is such magnitude that we couldn't possibly eat a comparable amount. But on the other hand, we live much longer. So the question is, eating small amounts over a long time, does that have the same effect? We know that it has no negative effect. So why not try to put as many berries into your life as you can? But of course, there are no magic foods, as I said. So in addition to the blueberries, you eat other stuff. Well, we're learning that there's other stuff that you can eat that's pretty healthy that may make you live longer. If we go off to Japan and Okinawa, and take a look at the Okinawans, who have the highest life expectancy in the world. They're into the 80s in life expectancy. What do? We look at their lifestyle. They are remarkably active. They don't sit and watch American Idol. They are out there working, they're exercising. They're very, very active. And they have a diet, which of course has been written up in numerous books. They have a diet that is basically vegetarian with fish. But the most important feature of that diet, I think, is that it's low calorie. So it's basically not what you eat that matters, it's what you don't eat. You can eat anything, you can eat anything that you want, as long as your total calorie intake is properly managed. That's what we're learning. Sure, it's good to eat lots of fruits and vegetables, but it's the total amount of food that we eat that seems to matter. The 120-year diet is an amazing theory put forward by Roy Wolford, a physician, who started out doing experiments on animals. And he found some interesting results. He allowed some rats to eat as much as they wanted. They had plenty of food in their cage. He put others on a restricted diet. And then he measured their longevity. And the ones on the restricted diet lived one-third longer. In America, we have a problem. Overweight. This is our biggest nutritional problem. Overweight is linked to numerous diseases, and it is linked to early death. Calories in excess are poisonous. We need to watch them. We need to watch them from early on in life. Very tough to lose weight once you start putting it on. There are other theories that are totally absurd. These are reasonable, what we just looked at. But there are others that are totally absurd. Of course, they sell better than all the reasonable theories. Because nobody wants to be told to exercise more and eat less, right? They want to be told that if you sit under a pyramid, the vibrational energy that focuses on your body is going to rejuvenate you. Or they want to be told that even if you die, you can be brought back to life sometime later. There are companies in the U.S., Alcor is the leader in this field, who after your death will freeze you in liquid nitrogen and put you into canisters and keep you on ice or on liquid nitrogen for centuries, hoping that eventually science will have evolved to the point that you can be rejuvenated, or reanimated is the term that they use. Strangely enough, they want payment up front for this process, which is not cheap. It's $100,000. For $100,000, you get a beeper, so that when you feel that death is imminent, you call them. And they come because you have to be frozen very soon after you die. So they will wrap you, freeze you in liquid nitrogen. The body fluids will be replaced by antifreeze. And then you will be stored in these containers in their facility in Arizona. Now notice that some of the containers are large, some are small. Because some are designed for total bodies, some require only heads. Because the theory is that if down the road somewhere, science has indeed evolved to the point where we can reanimate the dead, then surely we can clone the rest of the body. So that all you need are some cells from which the rest of the body can be made up. This is not theory, this is not fairy tale. For example, one of these containers, I don't think it's a specific one, contains the head of Ted Williams, one of the greatest baseball players who ever lived. As soon as he died, his head was removed. It is on liquid nitrogen there at Alcor, waiting to be cloned and reanimated. I think it's going to be a very long wait. That's the headless feature. There are some mindless theories out there too, like Deepak Chopra. If you read his books, they are totally incomprehensible. You take a look at what some of the words here, to transform the patterns of the past, you must know what they are made of. Your body appears to be composed of solid matter that can be broken down, lightning speed, I mean, all kinds of absurd terms, frequencies, makes no sense whatsoever. But Chopra is laughing all the way to the bank. He laughs at himself too. I, in fact, don't believe in the existence of time. That's one thing I have to tell you. And the other is that I don't take myself, what I am doing, seriously. But he takes serious money from people. Then there are regimens that are unproven, which may have some potential. Melatonin is a hormone produced in the pineal gland in the brain. And some intriguing studies have been performed with this one and in test animals. Back in 1994, transplant of the pineal gland tissue into young mice slowed down the aging process. They lived 27% longer. Unfortunately, there's been no follow-up, which I suspect means that there were complications that the researchers ran into because we haven't heard anything since. This very pretty tree, which you can actually see when you walk out from here on McTavish Street, up and down, this is the ginkgo biloba tree. And an extract of the leaves of this plant gives us ginkgo biloba supplements. There has been research on this in terms of improved memory. The results are very, very weak. There are some studies that show that if you memorize a list of names, you can remember somewhat better which ones you've seen previously if you're on ginkgo, because it does improve circulation to the brain. But there are also complications. If anyone is on Coumadin, for example, this will cross-react with it. And the evidence is just too weak to recommend ginkgo biloba. Fish, supposedly brain food. Again, this has been widely researched. And the omega-3 fats have been looked at. What we know is that during pregnancy, if women are supplemented with omega-3 fats, they do give birth to children with higher IQs. This has been documented. But in older people, whether or not fish can actually improve thought processes or memory, well, the jury is still out on that one. This seaweed has given rise to a remedy called Vivimind, which has been advertised widely in the Montreal area. There have been huge placards. This was a substance originally developed as a prescription drug for Alzheimer's disease. It failed the tests. So now they are trying to market it as a natural product against memory, because when you're marketing it as a natural product, you don't have to jump through the same hoops and hurdles regulation-wise as to market a prescription drug. Huperzine is an extract of a Chinese herb, which is also being explored for Alzheimer's disease, with possibly some merit. So there's very active research into that area. But finally, there are some proven things in addition to the diet. Exercise. If only we could bottle that and sell it. This would do the greatest good. You don't have to exert yourself tremendously. You don't have to become a bodybuilder. You can just walk around, and it works. People who exercise live longer. And I leave you with one anecdote, that of Madame Jean Calment, worthwhile looking at, because she defines the human lifespan, which is not the same as life expectancy. Life expectancy is what the average person expects to live. In North America, it's about 79 for women and 72, 73 for men. Lifespan is the maximum number of years that a member of a species has ever lived. For the human, it's 122, because Madame Calment died at 122 having had a documented birth certificate. So we know that this is the case. She was born in the 1800s. Pretty remarkable when you think about that. She was born at a time when there was no sound recording, nothing. This was pre-Edison, right? She knew Vincent van Gogh personally. Not a nice man, she said. She aged very nicely. At 115, she gave up smoking because she said she wanted to live a long time. She did. She lived another 7 years. And in her final year, she made a recording on a compact disc. That's remarkable. She was born before any sound recording. She went through the Edison cylinders, then the Bakelite records, then the vinyl records, and the 8-tracks, then the tapes, then the CD. Which just goes to show you the amount of technology that developed in that relatively short period of time in terms of history. She passed away at 122. Anyway, so what was on this recording? It was an interview with a reporter. And they had asked questions about her life and to what she attributed her longevity. She said, "Have sex as often as possible. And then the reporter asked, how often is that? She said, I can't remember. She also said she had a glass of wine a day. You can imagine that the French wine industry loved that. But what really captured the attention of the public was her allusion to chocolates. She said that she ate roughly a pound of chocolate every week. You know what the media do with that kind of stuff? All of a sudden, chocolate could save your life. This was the key to longevity. Well, it isn't, but there actually is some science there. Dark chocolate contains a very high concentration of antioxidants. It is a worthwhile dessert. It's better than the chocolate cake. But there are always new things coming out. I got this one in the mail. Advertisement, Youth Restorative X. I don't know what's in it. I sent for it just in case I might have some need for it in the future. So who knows? Next time I come back and speak to you, I may look like that. But you know what? I'm not betting on it. So I pass you on to Jill so that you can get your good dose, not only of food, but also of exercise.
I'm going to interrupt the flow here just for a second to tell you about Jill Barker. She's the manager of communications and marketing in the Department of Athletics and Recreation. She was instrumental in setting up McGill's staff fitness program. She writes a fitness column for the Montreal Gazette and has an extensive toolkit of practical exercises and exercise programs for the average Canadian who wants to incorporate more physical activity in her or his daily life. Jill?
So I thought we would start my talk with just maybe a very personal example of how exercise can make you feel youthful. So you all have to stand up. Great. So this is, can everyone hear me? Okay. This is one of the ways and one of the better ways that you can put some life back in your day, is get up off your derriere and stand up. It eases tension on your back and it starts to get the body moving again. So what we want to do is get rid of sitting and add more standing and activity. Now, it's hard to do when you're at a movie theater, you're at a talk, unless you're here, or you're in your office, wherever else. So I'm going to give you some kind of exercises that you can do in a confined space, so that if you're here and you've got two boring speakers that aren't really, you know, making you fall asleep, that there's a way for you to feel better during your day without thinking you have to get on your running shoes and your Lycra. So here we go. You can have a seat. All right. So we're going to start in a seated position, and I just want you to draw your ear to your shoulder. Try to keep the shoulder down. And relax. Now, take that chin and just direct it towards the shoulder. get a firsthand effect of what a little bit of exercise can do. You're thinking sharper. You're feeling a little more rejuvenated, and you're ready to refocus. But you know that already, because when you kids used to get bored, what did you do? Sent them outside to play, because you knew that they'd come back in a better mood than when they left. So you were already making, you understood the value of physical activity. So today we're going to look at how physical activity changes as we age. So the question, does age slow us down, or does slowing down make us age? And what we know is that when you're young, the idea of movement and the idea that kids should be active, we're okay with that. But we're also okay with the idea is that as you age, it's absolutely okay to slow down. But that thinking needs to change. And when I go and speak to grade schools, I say, all right, when kids get off a bus, what's the first thing you do when kids get off a bus? What do, the kids? They run. So do high school kids run when they get off the bus? No. Right? And does your mother or father run when they get off the bus? No. How about your granny? Does she run when she gets off the bus? Now the kids think that's absolutely absurd. Of course not. Well, because that's what we think is the natural course of life. That as we get older, we actually can sit and relax and take it easy because we've earned it. But what we're earning is just a nice, gentle slide into old age. Because physical activity keeps us feeling young. We know for a fact that as people age, and now more and more of the population are testing the boundaries of what they can do physically as they age. Like Chris Chelios at, 49. He's playing for the Detroit Red Wings. No, when I was in high school, that was unheard of, right? Athletes retired late 20s, early 30s perhaps, and now we have somebody who's competitive at 49. This guy, Ed Whitlock, he runs a 304.50, he ran a 304.54 marathon at 76 years of age. At 80, he ran 3:25:43. Anybody who knows anything about marathons, that he beats the majority of the pack on a marathon race at 76 and at 80. So I interviewed Ed Whitlock, and who really has, you know, he was a good runner in his youth, and he's maintained his running throughout all his years, but he really took it up seriously again when he was 40. And he had his best time at somewhere around 45, marathon time. And he runs almost an hour, he runs an hour or more every single day. Now, he's had a few injuries over time. He said that he's got knees that give him a bit of trouble. He has an Achilles tendon that gives him a little trouble. So sometimes he has to, you know, he has to just not exercise at all. But for a guy who's 80 and is running that kind of distance, he's got some kind of secret. I don't know what it is, so I asked an exercise physiologist, Russ Heppel, here at McGill. And I said, so I want to be like Ed. By the way, I can't run that fast now. I'm hoping that maybe by the time I'm 76 that I'll be able to match Ed. So I want to be like Ed. So I said, how do I be like Ed? He said, too late. You know, that's what Joe said, you've got to choose your parents wisely. And that's already been done for me. And he said there's something that he has. He is definitely an outlier. But he said it's not just so much, that's not exactly the time that Ed does that's remarkable. It's that Ed's body has been able to withstand that kind of physical activity, which is really on the high end for so long. So he's been able to withstand that activity for so long, and he's able also to have the drive to be competitive for so long. But Ed never gave it up. And Ed never said, well, now that I'm getting older, I can afford to, you know, slow down and stop and maybe start playing chess. No, for Ed, physical activity was always where he spent his time, and he always valued what physical activity could give him, and that is a healthy body and a healthy mind. Olga, at 92, she owns 16 world records in track and field. And I'm just going to, she had an interview done, and I'm going to play it here. Just before, Olga, for the, just before the Vancouver Games, she was one of the women who carried the torch. And she was interviewed, and I hopefully will get that here. And there's a little commercial I couldn't get rid of. So we'll have to.
Most people slow down when they get older. Yay! Olga Catalco sped up. Catalco throws herself into everything she does, be it a hobby like bowling or her passion, track and field. Catalco has set Canadian and world records in running and throwing events for her age group, and has the hardware to show for it.
I have already acquired 623 medals. And out of those, 600 are gold.
Catalco will be 91 next month and shows no sign of slowing down.
I don't know what's going on with me. I frankly do not know how come that I'm throwing the javelin farther now than I did, say, 5 years ago.
Catalco played on a softball team for years, but at age 75, a friend suggested a new challenge, track and field. She's never looked back.
And I love it. I love what I'm doing. Gives me time to travel, meet people, see the world, and as well look after my body.
Catalco knows she's a role model and talks to other seniors about staying in shape. She believes getting moving will only make you better.
I'm not old. I don't know what old is.
Having the chance to run the torch for this multi-talented athlete, well, seems so appropriate.
Can you see me standing and looking for the torch coming towards me? Well, I don't know what, I might cry. You never know. And it'll be great. It'll be just so spectacular.
As Catalco says herself, it's not how old we are, but how we get old. Leah Hendry, CTV News, Vancouver.
Yes, very, very inspiring. So Olga came to McGill, and I had a chance to meet Olga. And one of the things I noticed right away with Olga is we decided that we were going to go down into the fitness center because she can bench press about 60 pounds. And so I said, well, I got to see this. So as we're going down to the fitness center, Olga's going down the stairs. Olga did not grab a railing. At 91 years of age, she went down those stairs, no balance problems. Olga gets on, you know, goes down in what I call the little testy-festy corner where all the guys, the big guys, are working out and lifting weights. And she gets down there on the bench, and she gets the bar, and a couple guys go to help her, and she starts to do her reps. And all of a sudden, all these guys put down their weights, and they're staring at Olga. And then Olga, when we decided to take some photos of her, you know, throwing the weight, which is phenomenal that she can throw that weight. And so the photographer's down on the ground taking pictures of Olga, and she wants to see the photos, so she does this. Wow, that is something that is a measure of our day-to-day health. So, you know, maybe you can say, well, Jill, I really don't need to throw a javelin in my day-to-day life, and I'm not really sure that I need to do the triple jump, or maybe if I had to run to catch a bus, having that extra burst of speed would be helpful. But really, why? Well, Olga can go up and down those stairs. She's got great balance. She's got strength. 91, you saw how engaged she is. You also saw how competitive she is. When she was bowling and, you know, she got that strike, she was engaged. And when we were had her at the exercise lab up at McGill and we were doing some testing, man, she was in the zone. So Olga's competitive. But again, Olga was not an athlete as in her younger days. Olga started to become an athlete at around 45 and is largely self-taught. So it goes to show you that, you know, you can be competitive and you can become more active, even if the first half of your life you were more of a couch potato. Doesn't mean that the last half you have to mimic that behavior. So now I'm just going to give some basic tips on how you can be more like Olga, how you can be more like Ed, and how you can be more like another gentleman who I interviewed. His name is Roman, and he decided when he retired at the age of 50 that he was going to do triathlon. And so he used to cross-country ski, and he was relatively active, but he had to start like everybody else, a little bit of running, then he added the swimming, and he had the cycling, and he started doing triathlon. And at the age of 84, he was faster than he was at 82. And so we know that the body, once you give it a challenge, rises to it, regardless of what age you start. And where do you start? Right here. So, 30 minutes, most if not all days of the week. And that is exercise. And how do you define exercise? You define exercise as activity that makes you so you can hear yourself breathe. That's exercise. Versus strolling through the mall. Right? So if you pick up the pace and you hear yourself breathe, now you're in that exercise zone. So if you can find that zone, 30 minutes, most if not all days of the week, you're going to see, and what we have seen in populations who've incorporated that much physical activity is their risk of chronic disease goes down. Their life expectancy rises. So we know that has a huge effect on health, that little step forward in terms of a little bit of activity is better than none. The good news, too, is that 30 minutes doesn't have to be done all at once. You can break it down into little as 10-minute chunks three times a day. Because your body doesn't care whether you do it all at once or not, but by the end of the day, you want to accumulate those 30 minutes. That's your baseline. If you can go up even into 60 minutes, now you're even going to see more health benefits and more general fitness benefits. Those are the kinds of benefits that are going to make you, like Olga, you're going to be able to move with greater range of motion. You're going to be able to recover quickly a day after something, doing housework, doing the gardening, etc. You're going to have more longevity at the end of your day, so you're going to have more energy at the end of your day. These are the kinds of benefits that you're going to reap from this much physical activity. Again, in that 60 minutes, it doesn't all have to be done at once. It doesn't all have to be done at the same intensity. One of the things we know as we age is that even if you started at 30 minutes and you were doing 30 minutes of physical activity every day, as you age, your metabolism slows down. You're going to find that you'll put on those extra one or two, that middle-aged, you know, midsection, unless you bump up your level of physical activity. And they found that, in fact, in a group of runners, they found that even runners that were putting in 30 to 40 kilometers a week training still put on the same amount of weight as those people who were only running 17 kilometers. So whatever your baseline is, you need to kind of shock your body with a little bit more activity to try to ward off that middle-aged weight gain. So if your baseline is low, that's great. You only need to do that much more. If your baseline is higher, if you feel you can't do much more in that one area, so if you're a walker, then maybe you've got to try to get into the gym to do something else. So you want to really try to change and increase your physical activity as you age, not decrease. Yeah, I know, bad timing. It was a better slide a few weeks ago. As you age, even if you managed to keep, and you were lucky enough to keep the same weight from when you were in university till now, you can see that your body looks vastly different. Part of that reason is that natural loss of muscle mass that happens as you age. So what you want to try to do is get into the weight room or do some kind of weight training, whether it's with the help of a personal trainer or with a group, at the gym, wherever. Any type of weight training will help rebuild or retain muscle mass. And that muscle mass is important because, as you know, doing the things of everyday life, taking out the garbage, shoveling snow, whatever, you need that. You lose that, and not only do you have a different look in your body, but the day-to-day functions of life become harder. Challenge yourself. Getting older is not an excuse to say, oh, you know, I'm too old. I'm too old. I had a neighbor who, she was, I think in her early 70s, and she said, Jill, I'm making arrangements now so that my washer and dryer is going to be all on the same floor as my kitchen and so on, so that I don't have to go up and down the stairs with the laundry. And I said, yeah, but going up and down the stairs with the laundry is exercise. And once you give that up, it's not that you're getting older that means you can't go up and down the stairs with the laundry. It's because you've stopped going up and down stairs with the laundry. And so giving up those tasks, which we do all the time, and then spending the time that we've given up those physical tasks, like doing that little bit of gardening, and our life has become, we hire someone to shovel the walk, clean our house, do any of those more physical activities. Once we start doing them, we don't usually replace them with physical activity. We replace them with sedentary activity. And so as we stop doing physical activity, you have to, it's that use it or lose it proposition, you start to lose it. So you really need to avoid some of those very common ways to, instead of, remember when we used to have to get up to change the channel? Getting up to change the channel, somebody did a study, like Joe said, that these studies, I don't know who decided, but they just looked at how many calories you burned getting up and changing the channel versus with the clicker, and if you got up to change the channel, you can burn an extra pound of fat a year. So small little changes in our lifestyle have decidedly changed the way we look. And whereas we're always taking shortcuts, you know, a leaf blower versus a rake, right? Every time we take a little shortcut, we're normally saying no to physical activity and then spending more time in sedentary activity. And if you told my grandmother that if I told her that I was paying someone to clean my house, do my garden, and shovel my walk, and then paying $600 a month to go to the fitness club, she'd tell me I was crazy. Warming up. Definitely as we get older, it becomes harder to jump into activity. Little kids jump right into activity. They go from zero to top speed right away. As we get older, we need to increase that warm-up. That warm-up just means having some kind of rehearsal effect. So if you're a runner, you might start with a slower run or a walker. If you're a golfer, then you start take very gentle swings in a smaller range of motion. You move your joints through an ever-increasing larger range of motion, and you kind of do a rehearsal effect. Then you add a little bit of speed and a little bit of more range of motion. So toward the end of your warm-up, you should be operating almost at the speed you would for your activity. You notice I didn't say stretching in there. Stretching is not considered part of a warm-up. It's considered part of, you know, something that you should be doing regularly, but not as part of the warm-up, because you want to keep moving, get those joints moving and warmed up, and then move right away into activity. You want to introduce new activity gradually. So what we want to start activity, and maybe you know that, is that first time you get out on the golf course, the next day you pay for it. That's new activity, even though you're doing it in the fall, you haven't been doing that for several months. So your first day on the course you should be doing 9 holes. Or maybe that's a few weeks of 9 holes before you go out and do the whole course. Let your body adapt to new activity. Posture. Make sure that you spend time shoring up your posture. Poor posture brings a lot of aches and pains. As you know, people who are sitting at a desk all the time in this type of position, we've got a lot more neck and back and shoulder problems that have to do, one, with inactivity and poor posture. Taking yoga and Pilates is one of the best ways you can improve your posture. Consistency is more important than intensity. This is especially important as you age. So if you only go out 2 times a week, but you say, I'm only going out 2 times a week, I gotta work hard on those 2 days, you're going to be way more prone to injury. You're not going to enjoy yourself than be able to be more active every day. Flexibility. That any type of yoga or Pilates program, as we get older, our joints get stiffer. That's not news to you. It's not news to me. And what we do in life is that we also operate on a much smaller range of motion. So as kids, you know, they're all over the place. They take big movements. As we get older, we confine ourselves to much smaller movements. So then when we actually do need to reach up and get something out of that top shelf, it's like, whoa, because we have kept ourselves in that very small range of movement. So explore those larger ranges and learn how to hold them through any type of flexibility training. Balance begins to deteriorate around the age of 40. This is something you can work on very easily. You can work on this at home. And I tell people all the time, you brush your teeth, you stand on one foot, and you brush. And then you stand on the other. And you can do that because you've got the sink right there in front of you. You can do that while you're washing dishes. And so that you're starting to work on your balance. And you can regain balance easily. Just lifting your leg close to the body is relatively easy. As you move away from your center point, it becomes harder. So that's your next challenge. Taking that lift away from the body center. Right? In this type of posture, obviously, that's even harder. So you want to try to work on any type of balance so that when you do become unbalanced in daily life, you'll be able to right yourself. Mix it up. In your daily life, the type of activity you do, if you always are playing golf, you're going to get those hosts of golfers' injuries. But maybe if you alternate a golf day with an aqua fitness day, then your body learns to move in all sorts of different planes. A golfer are classically one-sided athletes. You saw that when we went to one side and the other. That's the kind of adaptation your body makes if you're doing the same sport all the time. So you want to mix it up so that you work both sides of your body, your upper body, your lower body. You go all through different ranges of motion. Rest. One of the things that I've had to learn as I've gotten older is I can't put together as many days in a row of physical activity. Like I like to run for an hour. I used to be able to run 6 and 7 days a week. I've had some injuries. Now my body responds a little bit better if I give a day off every second day or third day. And by day off, I mean day off. Maybe a swim, something else, but just a chance for the body to rest. And even in an elite athlete's training program, rest is part of that training program. One thing we learned as we get older is we do have to listen to the signals the body gives us. If you don't, you're bound for injury. So if something hurts, find out why. And we saw hurt is different than you know, that doesn't mean that I've worked hard and I'm tired. It means pain. Pain you investigate right away. I know. All of this is to say that as we age, we don't want to slow down. As we age, we want to be the Eds. We want to be the Olgas. We want to be her. And we can do that simply by following those rules of physical activity, gently getting back in the game, and telling our body and ourselves and our partners and our children that physical activity and exercise is good for us. I had a woman who was, I think I was coaching master swimming at the time. She was about 50, and she had some pain in her knee. And she said, I went to see the doctor, and the doctor said to me, oh, it's because you're old. She's 50. So I said, you need to find another doctor. And she went and found another doctor, and what happened is she just had some in her knee that she had to build up some strength in her knee. And as soon as she followed those exercises, she was out walking. It had nothing to do with age. So she went to see a physician who had a look at, she had gray hair, and put her in a box that said, you're old, you can't do. Don't go in that box. You're in the Olga box. You're in the Ed box. That says, I'm old and I can do. Thank you.
Well, these have been two very inspiring speakers, and now we will have some time for questions for either speaker. Here's the first question. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
think if you have to do intense exercise, you have to take that rest and listen to your body. I guess activity every day for sure. Movement. Yes. Oh, so why are you coming after? Yeah. Well, why don't you come after if it's a personal?
Yes, sir. I'd like to take the opportunity to add a point, even though I agreed with everything you said. I did everything that was mentioned with the Mediterranean diet, with the exercising 5 days a week, alternating a mile swim with an hour in the weight room every lunch hour. My blood chemistry was better than perfect. My pulse was better than perfect. My blood pressure was better than perfect. So I knew that what I was doing was correct. 3 years ago, after my mile swim, I dropped dead on the floor at the Pointe Claire pool. I wrote you about this.
Yes, you did.
So I've learned the hard way, which I'd like to pass on to people, that before you engage in high-end physical fitness, which I am totally committed to, go get yourself checked out medically. And even then, the most important thing I've learned, because I went to see a cardiologist annually every year, 15 years before my heart attack, and he didn't pick up on my medical condition. The most important part I learned the hard way that I'd like to pass on to you is our body sends us messages. And if you're tired, and I've learned this, especially as you're getting older, if you're tired, your body is telling you, slow down. And if you're still tired when you slow down, rest even more. You don't have to quit. Now I don't quit my mile swim. I still put the mile swim in, but I rest a lot more than I did the day I had my heart attack. Thank you.
Continuing in the water vein, what is, in your opinion, are the benefits of aqua fitness?
Benefits of aqua fitness are great. One of the things about aqua fitness is that there's very little impact. So if you've got knees and hips and backs that give you trouble, that's a great place to exercise. It also, because they have the resistance of the water and you're moving against the resistance of the water, you do get some, you know, gentle strength gains and endurance gains. I think it's a great place to work out. I taught aqua fitness for 15 years. I am a fan.
The question is whether it's a good idea to have a meal replaced with Ensure. Only if there is a medical reason to do that. Not out of convenience.
Other questions? Way over here. What does Olga eat?
I don't know what her diet is, but I'll tell you what they did do in the exercise phys lab is they took a little chunk of Olga's muscle. I know that sounds horrible. And what they're going to be doing is looking at that muscle to see what makes Olga different from you and I. So maybe I'll have more news to give you on that.
Yes, right here.